Item number 15 is a briefing, Atlantic Salmon and WDFW's authority. So, Ken, I'll turn it over to you, sir.
Thank you very much. As the slide says and the schedule says, I'm Ken Warheit. I'm the supervisor of the Genetics and Fish Health Laboratories for Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, and we've been asked to provide a briefing on Atlantic salmon commercial aquaculture in Washington State. I have 19 slides here, and I think we have an allocated 40 minutes, so if we can do it shorter for other people, that'll be fine with me. If I don't mind interruptions if you have questions. So the outline for this briefing is such. I'm going to touch on a history, and I'm not going to be comprehensive in that history, of course, of the Atlantic salmon in Washington State. I'm going to talk about WDFW statutory authority and how we apply that statutory authority. We will have a discussion also on Atlantic salmon aquaculture in Washington State today, particularly the Cook aquaculture. And in doing that, I will look, we'll have a slide on the location of the net pens. We'll talk about the life cycle of the fish from eggs to market and WDFW's how we implement our statutory authority through that life cycle. There are two fish health concerns that I'm going to touch on. One is disease transmission, and I'm going to use three examples, the three most prominent examples used for three most prominent examples that have been discussed in terms of disease transmission. I will touch briefly on antibiotic use, and then I will also talk, not extensively, but I will show a few slides on the Cypress Island number 2 accident where 160,000 fish were escaped. And then the last bit I'm going to talk about, the monitoring efforts associated with that accident, but also monitoring efforts and planning for monitoring efforts that preceded that accident. So this is a brief-to-bridge history, so basically it means that I'm not only going to be short on this thing, I'm not going to be comprehensive. From 1951 to 1981, the Department of Fisheries, which is predecessor of Washington Department of Fish and Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, released approximately 76,000 smolts in an effort to establish a viable populations, natural spawning populations in Washington. There were similar efforts that occurred up and down the West Coast, and I've heard numbers that over maybe 8 million smolts have been released. But in Washington, the data that I have is 76,000 smolts. All attempts failed. There were no success anywhere up and down the coast to establish a natural population. In 1972 was the first Atlantic salmon farm on the Pacific Coast, and this was actually done at NOAA at Manchester, and it was a part of a research program. From 1972 through 1982 was the beginning of the establishment of Atlantic salmon farms for commercial purposes in the state of Washington, but it wasn't until 1982 when the farms became large enough to be economically viable. Then 1996, 97, and 99, there were three large spills that occurred, 107,000, 369,000, and 115,000 Atlantic salmon escaped the net pens in all three of those years. I will add that there was no evidence that any of those spills resulted in an establishment of Atlantic salmon spawning in the state of Washington. I'm going to jump to 2016. That's when Cook Aquaculture purchased Icicle Seafoods, and they run the existing net pens as Cook Aquaculture Pacific. And then, of course, in August 2017, maybe the primary reason why we're doing the briefing right now is that we had another spill. So there was 18 years between spills there. 160,000 Atlantic salmon escaped from Cypress 2 net pen. Our statutory authority, specifically for Atlantic salmon net pens, there are other WACs and RCWs that apply to the authority for us to produce fish in hatcheries, and also for other aquaculture. Aquaculture is defined as a commercial entity by the state of Washington, but these WACs and RCWs are specific to those rules and regulations and laws that are associated with Atlantic salmon marine net pens. There are two RCWs that are part of the Department of Agriculture, but we are explicitly mentioned in both of those. One is the first one listed there for aquaculture marketing, and WDFW's role is defined as disease monitoring, and then in their 16.36 animal health, it again explicitly states that we are responsible for disease inspection, prevention, and control programs on these farms. You can see those three RCWs that belong to us. And then the very last one is where all the meat of our work takes place associated with the WAC. And I'm going to detail some of those right now of how we apply those rules and regulations and laws. And I've broken this down into there are five, and then the last one is not dictated by the WAC per se. There's aquaculture registration. Every aquatic farm in the state of Washington, whether it's land-based, freshwater, marine, must have a registration from the state of Washington, and that is renewed automatically each year if the applicant and the license holder is compliant with reporting, which is essentially the number of fish harvested and business, like the name of the farm and location and those sorts of things. So Cook Aquaculture has several aquatic registrations associated with their net pens and their hatchery facility. On top of that, there's a marine aquaculture permit that's issued by the WDFW director, and that is specific for marine aquaculture, in other words, the net pens. The permit is a five-year permit. It's good for it was last issued in 2014, so the current permit runs out after 2019, but the permit can also be conditioned. And the conditions are based on what the director feels is a concerns or needs to protect wild salmonids and wild fisheries. There are three things that are currently in the 2014 permit, two of which are dictated by OWAC. They require an escapement prevention plan, so we require Cook to provide us with that. We require an escapement reporting and recapture plan. Those two are spelled out specifically in that WAC. What's not spelled out specifically in the WAC, which is now included in the permit, is a pathogen, disease, and monitoring plan. I'm going to go a little bit more into detail later on about that monitoring plan. So those are two permits, one license and a permit. We also, by virtue of the WACs and RCWs, we are authorized to prevent and suppress disease, and we also require to monitor for escapees, and we are able to do that by going and inspecting the facilities themselves. If there's a disease outbreak or epizootic occurs at these facilities, the director may order particular actions to protect native fish, up to and including the removal of those fish. And perhaps the most important thing that we do in terms of on a regular basis, we issue these transport permits. Every time an egg or a fish, a viable entity, is moved from one place to another, it requires a permit. And I'm going to show you in another slide, the slide after the next slide, again, the life cycle of Atlantic salmon from eggs that come from Iceland to market here in Seattle, and show you where we implement these transport permits. The purpose of these transport permits to ensure that disease is not transmitted across the way. The last thing I put there is a comprehensive monitoring program that we're currently working with our co-managers, other agencies, and Cook Aquaculture. We started this process well over a year ago and well before the spill. And the reason why we did so is that we recognized about a year and a half ago, and we spoke with federal partners, that we thought there was some holes in where we applied our statutory authority. So we wanted to make sure we filled those holes. And this is the process that we used by doing that. Again, I'll detail that at the very end. So now focusing specifically on the net pens, Cook Aquaculture net pens, they are located in four general locations. On the bottom, you can see it's between Bainbridge Island and Kitsap Peninsula by the Manchester facility. That's in Rich Passage. Moving up, there is a net pen off of Hope Island by Laconner. Up furthest north there is that's Cypress Island. And there are three net pens there, and then Port Angeles. And then more specifically, you can see the net pens. You can see everything from Google. So Rich Passage, you have three net pens. One is the Fort Ward. The middle one is the Orchard Rocks. And the one on the left, you can see the Manchester Pier right off to the left of that net pen complex there, and that's Clam Bay. Hope Island, you can see it's a small net pen just north of Hope Island. You can look at Cypress Island. You have to the furthest south Bottom of the screen there, you have Cypress number one. Number two is marked there, and number three is above that. Number two no longer exists. That's where the accident occurred, and that structure has been removed. Port Angeles, you can see there are two net pens, a major net pen and a minor net pen right off of Edis Hook. Any questions so far? I'm talking fast, so I'm just trying to get through this. I've been asked to talk fast, and I talk fast naturally anyway. So this is the life cycle of commercial net pens for Atlantic salmon as Cook applies in Puget Sound. As I said, the fish are from Iceland. The eggs are originated from Iceland. There's a captive brood program in Iceland. This has been a domesticated stock for well over 30 years. It's a closed system and raised on pathogen-free water. We require, before those eyed eggs, those fertilized eggs, get moved to Rochester, moved to Washington, we require 100% testing of the brood stock. So all the brood stock that's been used for spawning to produce the eggs that come here are tested. And they're tested for the regulated pathogens, and the regulated pathogens are listed in the RCW and WAX. We will not allow any eggs to move here if they test positive for those pathogens. Next box, and as long as I've done this, and I haven't done this very long for the department, in no case have I heard of anything occurring. They've been pathogen-free at that Iceland facility for decades. These eyed eggs are then moved to the Cook facility in Rochester, and we issue a transport permit for that. So that's the first transport permit from Iceland to Rochester, and again, it has to be 100%. Pathogen-free. Part of that transport permit requires that once the eggs get into Rochester hatchery, they are disinfected and kept in quarantine until the next point in the process, until hatching, 30 days after hatching, at swim-up for these juvenile fish. These fish are then tested a second time. Obviously, we can't do 100% testing because we would kill all their fish, and that wouldn't work. But we test at 2%, what's APPL, which is assumed pathogen prevalent level. And what that means is we're going to assume that a particular pathogen exists in that population at 2%. That means 2% of the people in that population, 2% of the fish in that population have that pathogen, and we test at a level. We get as number of samples as needed to get a case of one of, to discover a positive from that. So that's the level we test. That's the second time they're tested, and we don't require a permit at that point, but we require a second testing as a contingency of that first permit. The fish are held. Once they show all negative for that second test, they can be moved out of quarantine. Juvenile fish are held at the Rochester facility for 12 to 16 months. During that time, there's disease monitoring, mostly by Cook. We have the statutory authority to go and inspect them. They have required reporting. Two reporting requirements are most important. One is if they have discovered through their routine monitoring, one, they have one of those regulated pathogens. Those regulated pathogens, as I said, they were defined in the WAC. There are five viruses and one parasite in that, a parasite for whorling disease. So if they discover a regulated pathogen, they must notify us, or if they have a disease outbreak, regardless of what that outbreak is caused by. An outbreak, an epizootic, has a very specific definition in the WAC. So, after 12 to 16 months, these fish are moved from Rochester into marine waters, but they can't be moved until the third test occurs. So we require a third test, again, testing at the 2% APPL. Once we receive those tests, then we will issue a transport permit if all tests are shown as negative. In addition, before those fish are moved, Cook Aquaculture vaccinates these fish, and they vaccinate them for there's always some experimental vaccination, but the primary vaccines that are occurring right now are for a series of Vibrio species. That's bacteria, so to prevent vibriosis. They also do a vaccine for furunculosis. It's another disease. And perhaps most importantly, they do vaccinate for one of those regulated pathogens, IHN.
Yes.
Okay.
I may be jumping ahead, but if
you, if any of those testing periods identified a pathogen, but not an outbreak, what would happen?
It certainly depends upon what that pathogen is and what their practices are right there. If it is a pathogen that's going to require any kind of therapeutin, a chemical therapeutin, there are federal and state rules as to how that can be applied. At that point, we don't dictate what they do. This is just a normal operation. When we have pathogens at our hatcheries, too. The rules state that there needs to be an established veterinarian with a bona fide client-patient relationship there. And there are very specific state rules as to how veterinary client-patient relationships are established and maintained. There are also federal rules in terms of what kind of medicated feed that they can give to these fish. So if they choose to, they may not choose to use any therapeutins at all. But that's the process. It's just the normal aquaculture processes in terms of maintaining health in that facility. Okay. Fish are vaccinated. The virus that they are vaccinated for is IHN. I'm going to get to that virus in a moment because that's a big deal. They're held in the net pens for 16 to 20 months. When they are market size, which is around 10 pounds, Senator Swecker mentioned that earlier, they're harvested directly from the net pens. And one thing I want to point out is they're harvested at the net pens. They are killed at the net pens. Heads, guts, separated. All of the blood water and all of the fish parts and offal are maintained in the harvest vessel. They're not put into the water. They're maintained in the vessel, so it's a clean procedure. The fish are then moved to port. The fish are offloaded, and all of the waste, including the blood water, are put into the Seattle sewage system by permit from Seattle, and I believe that Cook pays extra money because it's a large volume, and before that, I believe it's disinfected. So, any questions on this? Good. Thank you. So, moving now to the disease transmission part of this talk, most often you'll hear about problems and concerns about disease transmission related to these three pathogens, infectious hematopoietic necrosis virus, or IHNV. That is one of the regulated pathogens. The second one is Piscine orthorrheavirus, PRV. And also you would hear discussion about heart skeletal muscle inflammation. It's a syndrome people have associated with PRV, but I'm going to talk about that in a little bit of detail. And then we can't never talk about net pens without talking about sea lice. And then right after that, I'm going to talk briefly about antibiotics and feed. I don't want to spend too much time on this. This work is a lot of great work done at USGS. This is work that I'm showing here from Rachel Beretta and Gail Carath. The upper left slide there with the map shows the distribution of IHN in our system. IHN occurs throughout the Pacific Northwest. It's an endemic virus that affects our fish, and one of the things that we do is monitor for that. The large circles indicate lots of occurrences over the last 13 years. The small circles, only one occurrence. The tan or orange symbol is for adults, and the red is for juveniles. You can see the distribution. There's a high concentration there. You can see in the lower Columbia. And there's not a whole lot that occurs here in terms of numbers in the Puget Sound area where the net pens are located, but they occur around this area. Important here is that there are many different strains of this virus, but our concern is that there are four main categories of this virus. One is what's called UP. Its distribution occurs here. You can see that, and this is the virus strain, IHN strain, that occurs in Puget Sound. There's another strain here, another strain here, another strain here. You can see it, UP, UC, MD, and MB. So not only is there a geographic distribution here associated with these particular strains, but there's a host specificity for these strains, and there is also a mortality difference. And this is probably the most important slide I'm going to show you concerning the IHN. Right here, for sockeye, the UP, which is occurring in this area, affects, out of all the distribution for here, 87% of all the cases occur in sockeye. And they also occur in a minor way with rainbow trout and steelhead and with Chinook. But the important difference there between the distribution is that when it occurs in sockeye, it has high mortality. The pathogenicity for sockeye for the UP strain is extreme and high. But I will add it's also low for rainbow, Chinook, and steelhead. So rainbow, Chinook, and steelhead can get the virus, but they most often do not. The mortality is low for that, for them.
So I'm confused by the table. The percentages are the disease prevalence, disease incidence, or mortality?
So, thank you. Good question. Now that you ask it, the table is ambiguous under those things. So the percentages going down the row should, I'm checking what I've done here to make sure my math adds up, and my math does add up. Down each column, it should round to 100%. So of all the cases of UP, 87% of the cases occur in sockeye. Okay. And when they occur in sockeye, there is high mortality.
Okay.
But when they occur,
it's not shown in the percentages.
No, it's not. It's just those the occurrence of it. But it's lower mortality for rainbow, steelhead, and Chinook. If you go to the MB, any of the M's, MB or ND, you'll see that Oncorhynchus micus, rainbow trout, and steelhead, that's the strain that kills them. Okay. This UC clade is a little weird because mortality in general is low and pathogenicity is low on this. So, but the concern right here for the purpose of this talk right here is for the Puget Sound and UP. So this is sort of a summary of the general discussion concerning the spreading of the disease associated with net pens. And the concern generally expressed by the public is that Atlantic salmon amplify IHN, they make it more virulent, they shed the virus particles, and then putting our native salmon at risk as they swim past the pens and causing mortality for our native. Also, they point to the 2012 outbreak there. Prior to IHN vaccinations, which started after 2012, and this was when Icicle Seafoods owned the facility, there was an outbreak of IHN at the Rich Passage facilities. So I have a discussion section here. This is mostly listing some pieces of information that you may find relevant. As I said, IHN is a regulated pathogen, and the fish are tested prior to transport. I've already gone through that procedure. It is highly unlikely that Atlantic salmon will introduce an exotic strain of IHN. Prior to them being put into the net pens, they are tested three times. And these tests are very good tests. So we know pretty much that when we put these fish in the net pens, they are free of IHN. The IHN present in Puget Sound, as I just discussed, was the UP clade. UP clade has low virulence in Chinook, steelhead, and chum. Doesn't occur in the other species of Atlantic salmon, but high virulence in sockeye, and we confirmed, we meaning the scientific community, really USGS did the confirmation, that the 2012 outbreak was of the UP clade. Most likely, the fish, the Atlantic salmon, were affected. Got the disease, got the pathogen from free-ranging sockeye that swam by the nets. There's been also analyses that the dose of viral particles associated with that 2000 outbreak was far lower than that which would affect or infect Chinook, steelhead, and chum. So taking all this together, there is essentially a low risk that Chinook, steelhead, and chum populations in Puget Sound will be negatively affected by this particular virus, in particular the UP clade. There's a lot more words here on this, and this is perhaps right now the hot topic in terms of associated with diseases and Atlantic salmon net pens and potential threat. The concern is that PRV, the spicy North Aurea virus, is the causal agent of this syndrome, heart, skeletal, muscle inflammation, and that heart, skeletal, muscle inflammation is a deadly disease, and that PRV in the net pens will be spread to Atlantic salmon. They'll be amplified. Atlantic salmon will amplify and shed these virus particles to native fish, putting them at risk of getting HSMI and causing mortality there. Go through each one of these points as quickly as possible here. It is not a regulated pathogen. We do not test for PRV at our facilities, and we do not require Cook to test PRV at the net pens. Okay, I'm going to get to that reason in a moment here. PRV has been shown to be the causal agent, the etiological agent for HSMI, the syndrome, in farmed Norwegian salmon only in Norway. This has been only place where they've had a direct connection of the causality of the disease, HSMI, with that pathogen. HSMI can only be recognized by histopathology, and it can lead to death of fish. But my understanding from the Norwegians is that it occurs in between zero and mortality occurs roughly between zero up to 20%, but it's more like 0 to 5%. So many fish who get HSMI survive and live a fruitful life, I guess, until they go to market. HSMI has not been reported in any wild population, whether it's Atlantic salmon or Pacific salmon. It has only appeared in net pens. PRV as that virus is endemic in this area. Our fish have PRV, and it's been endemic since 1977, before Atlantic salmon were imported for commercial aquaculture. We don't know when PRV got here or how it got here, but it certainly wasn't brought in associated with commercial aquaculture.
Since it sounds like HSMI involves the parts that we eat, has there been any study on human impacts from eating fish?
You mean PRV, not HSMI.
Well, since PRV has been shown in one instance to be the cause, but the question is about the syndrome. You say it occurs in net pen Atlantic salmon.
In Norway.
In Norway only, okay.
Okay.
But do Norwegians eat those fish and does it impact them?
That's my question. I don't know the answer to that question.
Studied?
I can tell you that I pretty much, I don't buy cooked salmon I just don't eat Atlantic salmon. I eat lox, and I buy it from Costco, and it's from Norway. So, you know, so that's all I can tell you is that I'm eating it. So,
it still doesn't answer my question.
No, and I don't know the answer to your question. So, my apologies. Yeah. So, I mean, my guess is you need to talk to a Norwegian about that.
Well, no, my question really was, do you know whether this has been studied?
Oh, I'm sorry.
It is a human health issue.
Right. So, I am unaware of any studies, but the thing is that I haven't looked for those studies, and I'm assuming that the whatever the food safety authorities in Norway check for this sort of thing. And I think that they probably would not allow a fish to go to market if it was a human health concern. That's all I can suggest, but I don't have any direct knowledge of that. Okay. You know, I can ask and I can get back to you on that. Okay.
Thank you.
So, as I said, PRV is present in our system here. We have it. PRV occurs in Chinook, coho, pink. I have a slide that's on the next page. And steelhead in Washington, the first three, Chinook, coho, and pink. PRV occurs in Puget Sound area. I'm going to jump to the last bullet here in the discussion sections. The relationship between PRV and HSMI is complex. But the bottom line is that the presence of PRV genetic material in any test that we can do is not an indication of the presence of a disease. So given the fact that HSMI has not been discovered in any wild populations in British Columbia or down here, the association with PRV and HSMI has not been linked here. But it is complex, and more work needs to be done. This is just showing you quickly the prevalence of PRV in Washington. Just look at that bottom part of the slide. The number of populations tested This is based on one paper from Maureen Purcell from USGS, just came out, actually. We've tested 87 populations, of which 22% of those populations had positive for PRV. Among those, within those populations, we tested 1,522 individuals, of which 41 tested positive, so that's a rate of 2.6%. And that is, again, the virus and not the syndrome HSMI.
So is there any other pathology that's been associated with PRV?
So there is a pathology that's similar to HSMI called IBS, and we really don't know a whole lot about that, but it's, again, it's the link between PRV and IBS is needs to be worked on. What could happen with PRV is that it may result in these syndromes if conditions exist, and the conditions are probably the host, the immune system of the host, the virulence, and co-occurrence of co-infections. Environment, temperature, all that stuff is going to play into it.
Sure.
But it's not a simple thing. If you get IHN, you get sick from that. Well, the sock, I get fish. You're fine. So, okay. Okay. Sea lice. A lot of words here. I'm going to work through this again quickly. The concern by the public is Atlantic salmon in net pens will amplify and transmit sea lice, putting at risk native salmon populations. Sea lice, they're actually a copepod, an ectoparasitic copepod, a copepod is a crustacean. Sea lice is a major problem in Atlantic salmon farms in Norway, Canada, and elsewhere. They are a problem there. And that affects production from those net pens. It affects pest management controls, and they have to implement quite a bit of control elements that may have chemical therapeutins. They're looking for other biological ways of controlling for sea lice. Sea lice has also been implicated in transmission of another regulated pathogen, infectious salmon anemia virus. So there are control programs associated with sea lice to control for ISAV. There are empirical models and there are empirical studies and models that have shown that sea lice can be transmitted to wild populations of Pacific salmon and Atlantic salmon. Some of these cases are pink and chum populations in British Columbia have been affected by sea lice. There is not universal agreement among the scientists if that's the case. But clearly, Atlantic salmon populations are affected. Wild populations in Norway have been affected by sea lice. So this occurs in British Columbia, just north of us. It occurs in the Atlantic. We do not have a sea lice situation or problem in the net pens here in the state of Washington. Could be the aquacultural practices that are being incurred in the net pens. It could be the salinity of the water. It could be a whole suite of other things, but we require monitoring of sea lice. In fact, the Icicle, American Seafoods before that, and Cook haven't used any treatment for sea lice in over 10 years. Sea lice does not appear to be a problem in our net pens, so if sea lice do not occur in any large numbers in our net pens, the transmissibility of that to our native salmon is also a low risk. Any questions on sea lice or any of the other pathogens? Okay. So I'm going to touch very briefly on antibiotics because that is also a concern. And the concern for antibiotics is heavy use of antibiotics by fish farms can result in antibiotic resistance in the system. And that ultimately can affect human health as well. So at the beginning of 2017, the FDA implemented new rules concerning how one can give these veterinary feed directors or medicated food to farm animals, including our hatchery situation and these farms, cattle, pigs, the whole shebang. And the purpose of these new regulations were to prevent antibiotic resistance. This is the antibiotic use starting in January when those rules were implemented. We have data for time before this. I actually made this slide for another reason, and I ended it in June 2017. We have it through probably October from reports. These reports of reporting the medicated feed is a requirement of their MPDS permit with the Department of Ecology. You can see, for the most part, there's very, with the exception of the Port Angeles facility, there's been very little antibiotic use in these facilities. Only one case at the Hope Island in February 2017. There was quite a bit of use of it in the Port Angeles in April, May, and twice in June. I'm not a veterinarian, so this had to be prescribed by a veterinarian and implemented. I'm not going to second guess that veterinarian, but that does look like a pretty heavy use. But the veterinarian obviously prescribed it and thought it was safe at the time. We certainly want to watch for those sorts of things. But in the six-month period here, there was five cases, four of which were at Port Angeles and one at Hope Island, of use of medicated feed in the system. By comparison, during that same time period for WDFW, we had 29 cases in 16 facilities using VFDs. But in fairness, we have 83 facilities, and our application rate was lower than that of
Brad, I've got another question. So we're responsible for disease monitoring, statutory, WAC, and we see that the veterinarian is prescribing antibiotics in some of their net pen populations. Wouldn't that be part of our monitoring? Wouldn't we want to know? The assumption is that now, finally, since the FDA has finally promulgated rules about the USDA has finally promulgated rules about antibiotic use in livestock, it would imply there's disease. Wouldn't we have that as part of our monitoring? Wouldn't we want to know what's going on when antibiotics are prescribed?
The regulations are specific as to what pathogens monitor for.
Said that.
Okay. These are bacterial infections that occur, bacteria, right. Using antibiotics for these.
So Vibrio is not one of the ones that are...
At these net pens, they're vaccinated. These fish are vaccinated for Vibrio.
Yeah, I said that.
So the Vibrio...
Vaccines aren't 100%.
No, and they don't last for 2 years. They're good probably for 12 to 16 months, which is sort of the time period these fish are in the net pens. I'm actually going to get to Vibrio in a moment here.
Okay.
My phone is ringing. It's not ringing anymore. Any other questions on this? The point of this slide is that the application of antibiotics, we should have concern, clearly. But with the exception of the Port Angeles, it's been a low-level occurrence in these net pens, and it's not terribly different than what we do in our own facilities. One other thing I'll mention on antibiotics, there are required withdrawal times. So obviously they can't harvest fish if their fish haven't cleared that antibiotic. In other words, they can't apply an antibiotic a month before they're going to be harvested. There's definitive time where that antibiotic needs to be cleared. So let's just switch gears now. We're on slide 15 out of 19, the accidental release of Atlantic salmon. I don't even know how much time we have here.
Thanks.
The accidental release of Atlantic salmon, Cypress Island number 2. The accident occurred August 19th. That's when it began. WDFW was notified on the 20th early, within the required time period. We started having recovery fisheries. Were authorized by NOAA in August of on that Tuesday, I believe, that 22nd, and that was a recovery effort by everyone, a large effort by the tribes. August 23rd was daily monitoring activities. The governor on the 25th issued no new permit proclamation. The structure was stabilized a week later, and once the structure got stabilized, they were able to then start harvesting all the fish that were still in that structure. There was a formal end to the response. That was the government response on November 9th. We still monitor, and I'll get to that in a moment. There are 305,000 fish that were in the raft. We've been able to account for almost 201,000 fish. 146,000 fish were extracted from the net pen, so it never escaped at all. an additional 50,000 or so have been collected by various fisheries. The bulk of that, I believe, came from the Lummi. Biological data wasn't collected on the 55,000, but a significantly smaller subset of that. And the biological data, I'll actually get to some of those in a moment. The total number of fish that are now unaccounted for is 104,000. But I'll also get to that in a moment as well. Some of the data. This is in our records of these recovered fish. Two different tables here, both concerning the same 38 fish. Of the 38 fish, we had 29 of the 38, but there were 7 with no data. So it was 29 out of 31 fish had empty stomachs. They had not been eating. One had a food pellet, which was what they were eating in the net pen, so that really doesn't count. And then one had a small fish in it. So that was one out of the 31 fish that were looked at. So that was stomach content. The one on the right is gonad development. Again, 10, we have no data. We have the 38 fish, so we're looking at 28 fish. 25 out of the 28 fish had no gonad development, indicating that they were not sexually mature. They were, Senator Swecker mentioned that earlier.
So this is trying to dispel rumors or confirm them. Over and over, we've heard that that some of the female fish that were picked up by the tribes were full of eggs. Is that related to gonad development, or is that even true, or do you know?
So all I can say is that what we have confirmed is that there were very few. So gonad development would be related to not green eggs, but if they were filled with eggs, then they potentially in some period of time could be fertile. I am unaware of that information, so I can't say. What we have here is what we've looked at. This is on our database. Our veterinarian has looked at more than 38 fish, and the preponderance of those data are that these fish are sexually immature. Going back again to what Senator Swecker said earlier is that these fish are harvested generally 1 year before they become sexually mature, but there's always the ends of the tails of a distribution. So there probably are some sexually mature individuals that escaped. I don't think that there's any doubt of that. In fact, one individual in this had, and I believe that was a male and not a female. Okay. From a fish health standpoint, we have not examined all the. We've examined most of these 38 and other fish. We didn't examine the 55,000. Testing is not yet completed. Some of these tests take a little bit of time. Preliminary results is that the fish caught immediately after the accident appeared perfectly healthy. Okay, we've tested them for bacteria and viruses, and they were free of that. Fish caught after the accident, weeks after the accident, we were finding that most of them were unhealthy. And they were contracting local diseases like Vibrio, perhaps. We had tested 4 individuals. We sent it to a third-party lab, and 4 of the individuals that we tested were positive for that PRV virus. Was there, not positive for IHN, not positive for any of the regulated viruses, but 4 had PRV. We did histopathology on those fish, and none of them had HSMI. I do want to add, it's not on the slide because it's local, recent news now, there's been a report of fish being caught by the Upper Skagit tribe in the Skagit River. There were some fish that were caught before Thanksgiving, there were fish that were caught during Thanksgiving week, and there were fish that are being caught this week. One of my veterinarians has gone up and examined these fish, and also reports from the tribe indicated stomachs were all empty of these fish, gonads were undeveloped, and these fish actually appeared a little bit healthier than the ones that were in salt water. Vibrio is going to be more in the brackish and marine water and not in the freshwater. But they were all starved, they had no fat, and they were all about to die. So I can't tell you for certain where the missing 104,000 that are left or 100,000 that are out there, but the evidence points that these fish don't survive well in our system. They certainly won't survive without eating, and they're not eating. And for the most part, they are they're dead, but I guess there can still be individuals out there swimming around wondering when they're going to get fed. So,
thank you. And that time frame from when they are not eating but are picking up diseases to the time they die, or even after that, have they increased the odds of those diseases being spread to other native fish? Because they're just out there with diseases now. They picked them up. Could they then spread to other native fish?
Well, we also have thousands of our own fish migrating through at the same time, and they would have the same potential of transmitting diseases as well. The idea of disease transmission is basically in net pens, the fish are aggregated in a tight concentration where they can amplify the disease and spread it that way. Once they have dispersed, in fact, I think there's a map that I showed you a map here. Once that was a map of where they dispersed, they're no longer in that concentrated way. So, yeah, I mean, I guess that a fish, a native fish of ours can get a, can pick this up from Atlantic salmon, but they can do so also from the native fish and also from the environment itself. So I'm not an epidemiologist, so I'm not going to tell you what the probabilities are, but the probabilities are much lower since they're not concentrated.
Excuse me.
I can wait till you're finished if you aren't, but I do have a question.
Either way, I think I have two more slides.
I think I'll wait. Thanks.
Okay. So associated with these escaped fish, we have the following that we continue to monitor. We're looking for recovery of Atlantic salmon in existing fisheries, if they're present. That is the fisheries. Not that is the fish, not the fisheries. We monitor for Atlantic salmon through our normal agency operations, spawning ground surveys, traps, weirs, and hatcheries. And I would say that the tribes are doing this as well. We are also implementing a new eDNA monitoring effort. This is environmental DNA, where we're sampling water and looking for Atlantic salmon DNA in the water. We've tested the assay in our lab, and the green check means it checked out okay. The assay works. We also did a field test for this, and the field test is that we went to Cypress Island number one, and we took water samples right next to the hatchery, right next to the net pen, and then we motored out in various collection intervals up to 300 yards away from the net pen, thinking that we've cleared the zone of where we would find Atlantic salmon DNA, and we can get some at least those based on those tides and currents, what the distribution of that DNA is. And we got out to 300 yards, and we're still picking up Atlantic salmon DNA in that system. So our method works. So we definitely can look at it. We are in the process of having a sampling design, going through that, and how we're going to monitor them by taking water samples in the river. We did go up to this week. We went into the Skagit River, right where these fish were recovered, by the upper Skagit, and we took water samples there, and we also taken water samples at Nooksack, in the mouth of Nooksack. We haven't implemented the program yet, but we intend to do so. Last slide. I just want to go back to this monitoring plan that I mentioned earlier. We have started developing this. We received funding in September of 2016 from USDA, APHIS Veterinary Services, for the purpose. I pestered APHIS for about 6 months, and they gave us funding to do this monitoring plan. It's a one-year project. It's going to end. It started in February. It's going to end in February again. We started doing this when we discovered we thought we needed to pay more attention to disease monitoring when the fish are in the net pens. This is not a result of the spill. This is a cooperative project with WDFW, the tribes, Department of Agriculture, Cook Aquaculture Pacific, and we are getting technical assistance from NOAA, USGS, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services. The purpose of this monitoring plan is to establish minimum health requirements, inspections, surveillance requirements, and communication notification reporting requirements. We are going to determine which pathogens will be monitored and what procedures will be tested, and what particular biosecurity and disease containment plans, what those plans must contain. We are still in the process of drafting it. We hope to get an initial complete draft done in January, at which point then the public will have an opportunity to review this plan. And that is my last slide.
Thank you. Some questions? Yes.
So to synopsize in two or three sentences, we have statutory authority and maybe even a statutory mandate to allow these aquaculture to exist in our waters. Our job, Fish and Wildlife's part of the turf of this, is to ensure fish health, both of the fish that are in the pens and then, of course, the fish that are swimming around, especially the endangered species outside of the pens. So we heard a lot of, and so then we participate in these permits. At the time that this problem happened, we were criticized by some for issuing the permits that we issued, when possibly the governor indicated that he didn't think they ought to be issued, as did other agencies. My real question is whether we would have had authority, given everything you know about the fish health, to deny those permits, whether we have any authority when it comes to expansion of this private aquaculture endeavor, and whether there's anything for us to make a decision on as a commission on this issue. That's what I'd like to know.
So in terms of the transport permits, the one that occurred soon after the spill, so this would have been in September, this was the transport of fish from the hatchery into the Clam Bay facility. There was a second permit that was given for transferring eggs from Iceland to the Rochester facility. In terms of what restrictions we can, the director can put, doesn't have to sign transport permits, and could put conditions on transport permits. Not signing the transport permits, saying denying them, that's pretty well prescribed in the RCWs and WACs, and there has to be show a reasonable risk of effects to native populations. Cook has been compliant with all the requirements of those permits, and we did not see a reasonable risk by having those fish in those net pens, given pretty much what I've gone through today. So we would not have any legal grounds to deny that permit. I mean, I don't want to say legal grounds. I'm not an attorney either. There are a lot of things I'm not, and that's one of them, okay? But before we issued that permit, there was lots of consultation with the governor's office. And so it was our understanding that the governor's office moratorium on permits was new permits that were going to be granted by the Department of Ecology, and not in reference to these transport permits. So that was the first part of your question. The second part was...
Well, I think you just hit the second part. It's good for us to have an explanation of what our authority is in this and what we should accept responsibility for and what needs more interest. The second part was expansion. It sounds to me like expansion takes actual infrastructure, and that is not our purview.
That's correct.
And so somebody else will deal with that. And then my third question, which is just in your opinion, lots of times our excellent staff let us know if we have a decision to make. Now, we know that Raquel will be over there with all the bills that are going through the legislature. Perhaps we are best just waiting and seeing what happens. Is there any reason that you can think of that the commission needs to take any position on this matter at all?
So my role is to provide the agency with the hopefully objective interpretation of science that would be used towards policy making and policy implementation. The way I see the landscape right now is that there are bills being presented, and we staff are being asked to review those bills. I'm going to do what I do. I'm a scientist, and I'm going to review those bills for its objectivity in terms of the science. But policy and risk assessment. So one of the things that you guys can think of is that, you know, what is the acceptable level of risk? I mean, I can provide you with information, but that doesn't tell you that risk should be zero. I would argue that risk should not be zero. I mean, you had You took risk coming here today. You have risk drinking that coffee. All those things have risks. But you've done an assessment as to what the appropriate level of risk is. As a policy-making body, you can come up with a what you think is an appropriate level of risk. I can provide you with the information to help you make that decision. But I can't tell you what the acceptable level of risk are from a policy standpoint.
And thanks for that. We've heard a lot about this, and a lot of people are asking us questions. And I think, at least from my perspective, what I wanted for us to understand this issue. And you've done a great job explaining what our part of this is.
Okay. Even though we're 90 minutes behind, I do have a question. and I wanted to, it was about risk. And as I watched this, to me, the risk that you presented, both in the net pens, was low. And once the escape even occurred, you know, dangers that could be done in either through spawning or through eating other foods or having diseases was also low. It looked to me almost more like it was extremely low. I don't know if you can take it that far, but to me the risk was in all of this is a lot different than you heard about in the newspapers and you read it saw on TV or the rumors that you heard around or how people were talking. So I really appreciate the scientific part of this. But in terms of us, you know, thinking about that risk, I feel it's very low.
I'm not going to use the word low or very low, but it is, I mean, I guess I am using the word low risk because I have done that. Okay, I'm not going to say very low. So I do want to put a caveat on that, saying that given current conditions, given current virulences of our pathogens, given the current environment, physical environment, biological environment, I would say the chance for disease transmission, at least the ones I've talked about, is low. Okay. In terms of overall effects to the ecosystem, there's been, I mean, the Pollution Control Board, Washington State Pollution Control Board in 1998 ruled that from an ecosystem standpoint effects, the escapees is a low risk to our ecosystem for predation, competition, and for hybridization or spawning here. But I would say that if Cook makes a habit of having 160,000 fish escape every year, then that will change that idea. So it's pretty important that we don't have fish escaping. And I think it's important to Cook because they don't make money when that happens. So the low risk occurs given the current environment. Okay.
This is for my colleagues. Risk assessment is a really important piece of policymaking. I would just remind us that when we do risk assessment, which is always challenging because risk is subjective, that we also consider benefits. It's a balance.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just wanted to thank Dr. Werheit for his answers to the questions of Commissioner Bakers and other, and an excellent presentation. It gains our confidence greatly when we have our scientists not try to do policy, but be real good scientists. And so I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And I second all of that. And thank you. Very, very informative as a scientist. I appreciate everything you put up there.
You're also from University of Michigan, right?
Pardon?
You're also from University of Michigan, right?
Blue.
Go Blue.